It can be hard to eat healthy during the holidays. With all the prepping and planning and cooking for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and other large family get-togethers, I know firsthand it can be easy to forget to prepare nutritious, healthy meals for yourself. This holiday season, you might be looking for nutritious, convenient meals to keep you energized on jam-packed days. Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service, can help you fuel up for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. You'll save time, eat well, and stay on track with your healthy lifestyle while tackling all your holiday to-dos. Skip the stress of meal prepping over the holidays with Factor. Choose from 35-plus weekly flavor-packed, fresh, never-frozen meals that support a healthy lifestyle and meet your meal preferences, all delivered right to your door and ready to eat in 2 minutes. With Factor, you can rest assured you're making a sustainable choice. We offset 100% of our delivery emissions and source 100% renewable electricity for our production sites and offices. This November, get Factor and enjoy eating well without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered right to your door. Ready in just 2 minutes. No prep, no mess. Head to factormeals.com/BA2022pod50 and use code BA2022pod50 to get 50% off. That's code BA2022pod50 at factormeals.com/BA2022pod50 to get 50% off.
Hello and welcome to another draft podcast on the Baseball America podcast feed. I'm Carlos Galazzo, joined by Peter Flaherty. As always, today is November 30th, the final day of the month, and we are here to talk about our most recent 2024 Top 100 draft update. Peter, how are you doing? How was your Thanksgiving?
I'm doing great. My Thanksgiving, the holiday itself, was outstanding. A lot of great food and great company. The sports part of it, it couldn't be worse. It couldn't have been worse. as a Boston College fan, they started off the basketball season 4-0. They proceeded to lose two games in 24 hours to drop to 4-2. BC yep. football got throttled by Miami. And then the Seahawks on Thanksgiving night got beat handily by the 49ers. So sports-wise, it was a 20. Holiday, as always, was a 70. So I'll take it.
Okay. I would say my holiday was probably a 55 this year. We didn't get to go see family just because of some work obligations. Had to stick around here and all of our families back in North Carolina. But it was good. We had some good food. It was a nice, chill day. But I'd say mine's kind of the inverse of yours. My sports, not necessarily Thanksgiving specifically, but I mean, basically just last night, UNC basketball beats I think they're a number 10 ranked Tennessee team that supposedly had the number one defense in the country entering the game. And my Tar Heels put up 60 points in the first half. They got a win. Duke basketball took the L in the same night. That's always a phenomenal day in the Collazo household over here. So I can't complain about my college sports fandoms. They had a really good week.
Must be nice. I haven't had one of those weeks as a BC fan in probably 15 years. So,
well, I mean, if you're a Wake Forest fan, maybe you were happy with us on the BA front, because on our updated draft list, I think we can take this conversation in any direction you want to go, Peter. I just felt like it would be fun to talk about the top 100 update on the site right now. You can see the list with full scouting reports. We also have a supplemental piece with that, just looking at 10 of the more notable risers on the board. Seaver King, Caleb Bonnemer are kind of the guys that are topping that list. But in terms of demographics and schools, it's almost shocking to see Wake Forest with this much talent at the top. It shouldn't be shocking. We've talked about it. We know about the transfers who have come in. But to have five players inside the top 35, I really need to go back and look and see what our most loaded school is in any given draft year. Like, what team has had the most top 50 prospects on a draft board? Because I would imagine this team would be up there with some of the better ones we've had, some of the Vanderbilt teams of old, some of the Florida teams, LSU. I'm not sure if they had a team that would have quite that many in recent years, but man, it's pretty impressive. Nick Kurtz is number one on the board. Then you have Chase Burns and Seaver King at number 7 and 8. You have Josh Hartle at 16, and then Michael Massey at number 35. So it's a new day for Wake Forest at this point. I feel like they are one of the premier college baseball teams in the landscape, at least in terms of prospects at this point. How I mean, what are your thoughts on Wake? What are your thoughts on the top 100? Are there any notable directions you want to take this conversation?
I guess starting with Wake, obviously super well represented with the five in the top 35, and then even narrowing it down more, three in the top eight. And I think that what they're going to show this year and then in years ahead with Coach Walter and kind of this new era in Winston-Salem is that the Omaha run they had last year wasn't kind of a one and done, like once every 50 year type of thing. Like they're going to have a seat at that table on a pretty regular basis. And looking at the team that they have this year, I mean, they're very well positioned to make that run again. And you talk about, I think Chase Burns right now, again, a lot can change in the cycle and so much will change as we go through the season. But I think right now he's probably the top arm on the board. Like, I mean, he is where he's stationed, but I think that right now, like it's a little, I think that right now he's pretty clearly the best arm in the class. That's not to say that someone like a Brody Brecht or even a Josh Hartle, a Jonathan Santucci, if we want to get a little more sleeperish, can work their way into that conversation. But I think Burns right now is the top arm. And then going back to King, it's been nothing but rave reviews on him since even last spring at Wingate when he started to turn some heads. I think that he's going to be one of the more dynamic players in all of college baseball. Was the best D2 player last year, was excellent on the Cape and with Team USA. Super explosive operation, big time bat speed. Like, I mean, he's turned in 70 grade run times. I think that the only question mark with him right now is, okay, where's this guy going to end up positionally? I don't think there's a slam dunk, but I don't think that it's a positional gray area that's a negative like some of these other guys. Like, he is super athletic where he can hold his own at short. He can probably hold his own at third. He can certainly play second base. But where they've tried him this center, this fall, is in center field where his speed and athleticism have translated really well. And if he can establish himself as a pro center fielder, I mean, it's like he is a 1-1 dark horse, I think, in my mind. And I think that he's probably the type, especially in that ballpark, to have a chance at a 2020 season. And I know I've been the like yelling about Seaver King for a while, but I'm very excited to see what he does in the ACC because he also has the benefit of establishing, although not as lengthy as other guys, this wood bat track record of success in the Cape and success with USA. So I'm very excited about him as a player.
I am too. I mean, I'm still waiting on the first piece of feedback from any scout in the industry that does anything other than raving about him. Like, his track record is phenomenal. He's hit really everywhere he's been. Obviously, Division II to Division I and getting into the ACC will be a new challenge. But the fact that he does have that wood bat track record, the fact that he does have a really appealing up the middle profile, it's a very exciting player. And if he is looking at an outfield tag next spring, I think he fits squarely in that Mike Sirota, Vance Honeycutt mold, and you could maybe even say you'd prefer him over those two players for various reasons. But I think it's interesting that Wake Forest, they've never had a hitter selected inside the top 10 picks, and based on our board right now, they have a chance to get two next year, which is a pretty loud way to snap that streak for your program. I also think too that, like, looking at our top 10 here, it's all college players. We only have 9 high school players inside the top 30 picks on this board. So it's a very college heavy top of the draft class as it stands right now. Really, what stands out to me about this draft class is just how muddled it really is. Like, I maybe view the top 10 as like a single tier in and of itself. Like, I don't know that there's too much separation between guys like Kurtz and Weatherholt and Bazana at the top to a Seaver King or a Braden Montgomery or a Tommy White. Like, I think it's wide open. It's certainly not the same sort of board we were thinking about a year ago around this time, where Dylan Cruz is clearly the top guy. Chase Dullinger was clearly the top college pitcher. I know you mentioned Chase Burns. He's in that spot now, but the separation between Chase Burns and whoever you wanted to put as your number two pitcher, whether that's Brody Brecht with Iowa, Josh Hartle at Wake Forest, Hagen Smith at Arkansas, if there's someone else further than the board that you really liked, like, I don't view a ton of separation between Burns and whoever that second pitcher is compared to just the way scouts were talking about Chase Dullinger and kind of how he had established himself in that spot a year ago at this time. Obviously, Dolander wound up kind of falling down the board a little bit. He went third in terms of the college pitching pecking order, and no one could have really anticipated what Paul Skeens did. But I guess I'll just reiterate that regardless, any given draft class at this stage in November, there's a lot that's going to change, but it feels especially so for this 2024 draft class.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch it play out, because while it doesn't have like the Dylan Cruz or a Paul Skeens as last year, it's going to have so much volatility, and the talent really isn't as far off as you'd think. Like that trio up at the top, the trio of bats with Kurtz, Weatherholt, and Bezzana, with more eyes on them this spring, with it being their draft year, just more eyes in terms of the general public following them, they're going to be pretty blown away with what they see, I think. I had the privilege of watching JJ and Travis on the Cape, and they even exceeded my already high expectations. And then going back to your point about this kind of the top 10 being its own tier, even the in looking past it at these first three prep guys with Connor Griffin, PJ Morlando, and Caleb Bonnemer at 11, 12, and 13 respectively, they're also right there. Charlie Connan at 14, even, like, you can shuffle them.
Yeah, it wouldn't be surprising at all if Charlie Condon just went off and was a top five pick next spring.
Right, like you can shuffle them a lot of different ways, and I'd probably hear you out on why you have so-and-so here and so-and-so there. So that's what's going to make this class really fun. And then in terms of the number two arm, like you said, it is kind of pick your poison, at least right now. And I mean, I'm going to stick with the Wake theme here. It's probably Josh Hartle, and he's got the best pitchability in the class, either him or Danny Avedia from Grand Canyon, who's also going to be a high pick in his own right. Hartle this fall has been up to 95, two distinct breaking balls. But I mean, the calling card is that mid 80s, low 90s power cutter that's just lethal. And I mean, he's got a true five pitch mix. 6'5 left-handed starter up to 95 with a pretty aesthetically pleasing delivery. That's going to be really hard to pass on, and you can only pass on it for so long. So it's going to be very fun, like this draft cycle, because there's going to be so much movement, probably not fun trying to keep up with all of it, but everyone is going to have, I think, different thoughts on the class and their own preferences. And it's going to make for a really fun year, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be a draft class too, where I think, like you said, depending on your preferences, what you value in a prospect, what your team values philosophically, could really shape how you're lining these players up. Like for me, it was really tough between Connor Griffin and PJ Morlando as to who was going to be the top high school player in the class. And a lot of our list is driven, I mean, almost entirely our list is driven by industry feedback. But I did talk with some scouts who really preferred Connor Griffin because he has that prototypical projectable size, the athleticism, the tool set. And they were like, hey, with Pedro Morlando, you're looking at a probably first base profile. Like for some teams and for some scouts, that's not a really sexy profile. And then for other teams and scouts, they say, you know what, like at the end of the day, the hit tool is the most important. And PJ Morlando was the one guy in this high school group who consistently went out and hit. He hit for impact. He has a great approach. If you don't feel like there is this elite kind of combo of hitting ability and tools, like let's say a Bobby Witt Jr. a few years ago, who was pretty like checked off every box you wanted from a high school player, like it can make sense that you would rather go with a PJ Morlando if you have hit tool questions about a Connor Griffin. So deciding like which of those two I like personally is difficult, and also just trying to find any consensus, if there's any to be found in the industry between these two. And then right in that top tier of high school players, we now have Caleb Bonnemer. He was probably the biggest riser in terms of movement up the board since our July update, because he entered the summer not on our top 100 list. I guess Ben really hated him when he was doing the underclass stuff, but Bonnemer really just went off. He has a really exciting combination of physicality, power, speed, athleticism on the left side of the diamond. He plays shortstop now. It might be more likely a third base profile. And I think in some ways you can make some Brady House comparisons because of that. House was a shortstop in high school, but he was big for the position. He was physical. He had power. Both of them moved pretty well. So I think Bonnemer probably will get a shot to play shortstop, but it shouldn't surprise anyone if he moves off the position. But just in terms of what he did offensively, he hit at a high level at multiple really important events. He hit for power. He squares the ball up. So he jumped up the board pretty highly. I know previously you talked about how he was your favorite high school infielder of the class. He's now in a more appropriate spot on the board there. And since he was not one of the players that we went through in kind of our series breaking down five guys, I wanted to let you speak about Bonnemer if you had any thoughts or takes on him.
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth when you went to Bonnemer, because I was talking to a couple of scouts recently, and there are some that have him as their personal top high school guy in the class. And you hit on it. It's due in large part to the loud summer he had, especially with the bat at these high profile events, most notably Area Code. I think he had over 500, had a really loud showing on national TV on the PG All-American Classic. And if you take out just kind of the one rough stretch that he had of the summer with USA, across all the events and his travel baseball and kind of adding up all of these stats, he slashed 431, 541, 723 with power numbers, generates big time impact, especially the pull side. He's a good runner. The arm strength is there to stick on the left side of the infield. I think just in looking at him and how he moves, I think he's probably best and is going to play third base professionally, but I really like the swing. There's not a ton of movement. It's the barrel explodes through the hitting zone. He's a very mature hitter, wise beyond his years. And I think that he's going to be right in that top 20 overall or so conversation for the entirety of the cycle. And the debate with him, Griffin, and Morlando is going to be really interesting, because that, for my money's worth, the top pure hit tool, it's still Morlando for me. And we'll get into, I know probably our next holiday episode around Christmas will be doing what we did last week, except on the high school side, which that'll be interesting because I'll have to go deep down the board to finish off my guys. But in terms of a pure hit, it is Morlando over Bonnemer. Again, though, I think that the gap is closer than people realize. And then Griffin being that just tooled out freak. Mm. But Bonnemer's bat is for real. Again, it's a very enticing profile.
Yeah, it's almost like we have the full spectrum of what sort of prospects do you like here, with the extremely polished hitter, lacks projection on one side, and the, like, let's dream on everything, like uber tools, uber athleticism on the left side. It's like Connor Griffin would be on that far left side where you can dream the most on him. His pure upside is probably higher than anyone in this high school class and probably higher than a lot of the college names in front of him. But there is some risk there to the profile given his hitting ability. Caleb Bonnemer, maybe you could slide him more towards the middle where he does have a few loud tools between his raw power and his speed. He had really good track record of hitting this spring. Maybe you feel good about his left side of the infield profile, but there is still some risk here. He doesn't have the same underclass track record as Griffin and Morlando do. And then PJ Morlando, he probably has the worst defensive profile of the group, but he's the only left-handed hitter. And I have to imagine you have as much conviction in his hitting ability and power as anyone in this class. And so if you just want safety and security with your picks, like, it would be a pretty easy case to make with Morlando being that guy. So it really just depends on, like, what are you looking for with a high school prospect. I mean, even in terms of age, it kind of works well too. PJ Morlando is the oldest of the group. He's 19.2 at the day of the draft. Connor Griffin is the youngest of the group. He's 18.2. And Caleb Bonnemer is right in the middle. He'll be 18.8 on draft day. So it is interesting. And I think it largely just depends on, like, what your preferences are as a scout, your tolerance for risk, and maybe even, like, when you actually saw these guys during the summer.
Yeah. And you mentioned it too with the age. It's funny how that works out. And then I think, like, in looking towards the high school arms, that's when it gets really kind of hairy. Yeah. For me, and I think that one guy that I'm really, really intrigued with and excited about the upside that he brings, and he's not even viewed right now as a PO in the industry, and it's a pretty split camp maybe leaning this way now, but Bryce Rainer, I'm really excited about his ability on the mound. Like, it's an easy 96-97, won't sit there, but he's been up to it. With a big time breaking ball, if he can get some more field of pitch, like, he moves really well. I love the arm action. Like, he's a guy that I could see, if he focuses on pitching only, being a upper 90s type arm. And it's a great body. I think he's 6'4", 195 or so. He at Area Code, I know you saw him live, and it was just kind of like this, like,
whoa, it was a wow performance for sure.
Yeah. And so the upside there, it's a big time upside play with Rainer, regardless of what he does this spring on the mound. It is kind of you're looking towards that ceiling that he has. But man, is it a really, really high one?
Yeah, I agree. I think it is interesting with this class. We have more two way players collectively than I think we have had in years. Starting at the top, you've got Jack Caglione, who's obviously the most famous two way player in the class and maybe the most upside on both sides. You've got Braden Montgomery, who's a two-way player in his own right. Connor Griffin, who we mentioned, and we didn't really talk about a ton as a pitcher. I've talked to some scouts who almost prefer him as a pitcher. I think most people in the industry prefer Connor Griffin and his upside as a hitter, but he's a talented pitcher in his own right. We have Bryce Rainer. I'm with you. I really love him on the mound. It was almost shocking how easy he got to his velocity, how easy he broke off a breaking ball. I really hope he's pitching a lot this spring. That's something he hasn't done a ton in the past with his high school, so I hope that happens. Cam Caminiti, I think, probably more likely to be a pitcher. Most people in the industry like him as a left-handed pitcher. He is the top high school southpaw we have on the board right now, but he's a legitimate two-way player in high school, and if he got to college, I imagine we at least have a chance to do both. Noah Franco, same thing, IMG Academy left-handed pitcher and outfielder. Kind of at the opposite of Cam Caminiti, I like him more as a hitter. I think most of the industry is leaning towards him as a hitter, but he's a talented left-handed pitcher in his own right. Kind of scrolling down the board more, we've got Carson Benj at Oklahoma State, outfielder and right-handed pitcher. We've got Will Turner at South Alabama. There are a number of high school players as well further down the board. Cole Mathis at College of Charleston. There are just a lot of like legitimate two-way players who are all not going to be two-way at the next level. Like at some point they're going to have to pick a side and play one, but figuring out which side you want them to focus on or figuring out which side you prefer their upside long term will be interesting. And I really can't think of a class that's had this many legitimate two-way talents, so that's maybe another wrinkle to this draft class that'll be interesting to watch unfold.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be interesting to watch how it plays out. And then with you bringing up Benj and Cole Mathis, that kind of it's a little bit of a segue to, I think, yeah, like these guys maybe in the middle of this top 100 who are kind of lurking in the weeds, so to speak, where there is a ton of room for them to move themselves and push themselves way higher, even into the first round. I guess before getting to that, mentioning another big riser, Caleb Lomavita from Cal Berkeley. Yeah, he's, again, including Jacob Cozart, who I know he's a great catcher in his own right. He's a likely top 30, 35, 40 type pick. But my favorite catcher in the class is actually Lomavita from Cal. And in 2023, he was outstanding. He tapped into his power, 13 doubles, 16 home runs. And I've seen him now for two summers on the Cape, and it's legit 60 power that he gets into in games. And he's made some really positive adjustments in the operation. It previously used to be a really high leg kick. He's now kind of dumbed that down. It's a loose handset. I really like the swing. He rotates super well, gets great extension through the ball, and there's present bat speed there too. And the power that he's able to generate, especially to the pull side, he has hit with wood legit big time, no doubt home runs, where I'm this is big time. And I think that what I've seen with Lomavita is not only an established track record where he was really solid as a freshman at Cal, had this great sophomore year, but he has across two summers on the Cape, he's a two-time All-Star and has a career slash line of 323, 364, 460. And that's against the best talent in the country. And then not only does he have the track record, he continues to make these positive tweaks to his game that pay dividends and help maximize the upside that he has. The bat to ball skills have really improved. In 2023, he had a 90% in zone contact rate and 91% against fastballs. The chase rates have lowered. There's the one bugaboo in his game, and he knows it too, is right on right breaking balls and picking up spin out of the hand. That's the biggest tendency he has to expand the zone, and he'll run into trouble there with chasing those. But Like the hit tool has really improved. It's a borderline 55. And then again, you have this super, super athletic catcher, like moves extremely well behind the plate. The defense has taken big time strides. The catch and throw skills are really, really good. Like he is popping 185s, 187s in game, and the arm strength he's getting off some throws that I'd grade out as a 60. And then I think that the most underrated part of his game is he's a plus runner. Like he's going to steal, if they let him run at Cal, he's going to steal 15 to 20 bases. That's how quick he is. And he's athletic enough for, you know, they'd even have him run around in center field in the fall. So I think like when looking at catchers and like where guys can go, like I don't think that Loma Vida is going to last all that long, especially if he continues to hit at Cal, where I think the Pac-12 as a whole is an RIP after this year. But like as a whole, the Pac-12 is probably the most underrated conference in baseball. And I say underrated because I think that it's probably the most polished baseball in the country. Like you have the loads of talent in the SEC and the ACC, but the Pac-12, I think, is the closest thing to like a clean professional game with probably the most advanced arms, I would say. Like all of these guys know how to pitch. Like they'll pitch backwards.
It does seem like there are a lot of West Coast college programs who have a reputation of getting a lot of these pitchability arms and guys who are maybe not the most highly regarded coming out of high school, but it does feel like every year there's a handful of really command oriented pitchers who are like maximizing their stuff. So it's funny that you say this.
Exactly. So like, I'll get off my soapbox, but Loma Vida is a guy who he got a pretty healthy bump up. He's sitting there at 25. I think that he'll probably sit in that range, maybe a little bit higher.
Yeah. That's a good one. Let me go further down the board and stick at the college catcher demographic, because this is a player who
take another guy that I was going to talk about.
Yeah. So let's get into him. Like this guy didn't rank on our top 100 entering the year. He probably was in a range where he easily could have been at the back end of the list. He's still in that like 80 to 90 range here. So like top three rounds is basically what a top 100 list is trying to convey. Anyone who's got a chance to go in that sort of range. And this player is Walker Janik. He's a catcher at Sam Houston State. He is a player who, as I was going over all the data, all the feedback, notes, just talking with scouts and watching him more, I haven't seen him in person yet, but I really started to like Walker Janik quite a bit. And it wouldn't shock me if he was a guy who continued to move up the board. His performance offensively at Sam Houston State has been very solid for 2 years. He's a 300 plus hitter in back-to-back seasons. Overall, it's 303, 402, 506. He went from 7 home runs as a freshman in 2022 to 13 home runs in 2023. Add a little bit more slug, 4 doubles to 17 doubles. He also played in the Cape Cod League this summer with Falmouth, where he was solid there. He hit 281, 364, 474 with 5 homers. So the offense is fine. It's very solid. I think maybe there are some things we could critique with the swing if we wanted to, but defensively, he looks phenomenal behind the plate. I think he has a reputation as one of the better catch and throw backstops in the class. I'm curious if you think like he is the top guy there or which other players you would put in that conversation. But if you want a catcher, and I think college catching is probably the one demographic that will consistently get pushed up boards because every team needs catchers in their organization. Teams really are scared of the high school catching demographic. It's perhaps the riskiest overall. And so then you get these college catchers who maybe you have to project less on defensively to stick at the position, and you also feel good about whatever their college offensive performance is. You wind up with those limited profiles that you get in any given draft year being moved up because there just aren't that many of them. But Janik looks the part behind the plate. He presents the ball well. He sits athletically behind the dish. He really folds up with a one knee setup well. He moves well to the side. I thought he blocked the ball well and centered balls well, both to his glove side and to his arm side. He's quick with his release. He's efficient on his transfer. I thought it was plus arm strength. He was getting some 1.85 second pop times in game when I was watching him with solid accuracy, solid carry. I mean, between both of his seasons at Sam Houston State and the Cape Cod League, he's thrown out 27% of base runners, which is solid and honestly a little less than I would have expected given his defensive actions. But man, I really like him as a defender, I feel like the profile is like one of these high floor types, just given his defensive ability. And like you said, with Loma Vida, he's also a really good runner for a catcher. He stole 6 bags his first year with Sam Houston State, and then he added 10 in 2023. So I really came to like him quite a bit. If he takes a step forward offensively, then great. I mean, there is some swing and miss against secondaries. He'll expand the zone a little bit, but it's been fine performance, and I think he has solid contact skills as well.
Yeah, you summed him up really well. Like this summer, he was a guy that I became pretty enamored with. You mentioned the track record at Sam Houston with the bat. He's taken a step forward year over year in terms of production, especially on the power side. And I was honestly, like, to be quite frank, I was pretty surprised he wasn't an all-star on the Cape this year.
There have been a lot of questionable decisions with what happens with catchers in the summer at various events and leagues.
Yeah, so like we're talking about a catcher who hit 281 with 5 doubles, 5 bombs, and 17 RBI in 30 games, and he was outstanding with the bat. Like at least when I saw him, I saw plus raw at least a strong 55 with him. If someone wanted to call it plus, I certainly wouldn't have any gripes with it. But you mentioned it with him, it's the defense, and he's a little bit reminiscent last year of kind of a guy that you can point to and be like, hey, he's the guy defensively in this class of Connor Burns from Long Beach. It's a one knee setup, and like being like the old spirit that I am, I was curious to see how it would work. He made it work just fine. And I get the whole question mark around it and all this, but if it works, it works. And he handles balls in the dirt well, he moves well. The catch and throw skills, I think, is what really sets him apart. You mentioned it. He's got really good feet, quick transfer. It's a 60 arm. And then in terms of throwing guys out, this summer he threw out 36% of potential base stealers, which was probably like that number that you were expecting to see.
Yep.
And so now you're talking about a catcher who has a track. And again, what you mentioned at the end, which I think is underrated, like there's some swing and miss with his game. And I think that comes to maybe the approach not being super, super refined. Like there's stuff to clean up there, but the bat to ball skills and feel for the barrel, like it's there. Like there was his zone contact rate this year, I think last year was 87%. And then I think against fastballs, it was 90%. So like, you know, he's got a little bit of a feel to hit. So now you're talking about a catcher who is a 60 defender. He's got a 60 arm for sure. And he's got borderline 60 raw, and if he can establish his hit tool as like as comfortably average, again, like that's someone who I wouldn't be shocked at when we're sitting here on day one of the draft and you're on MLB Network, he's a day one guy, like end of day one guy, because I think that, again, like he opened a lot of eyes this summer. He's going to get heavily scouted. He's someone that guys are going to go see this year down at Sam Houston State. So I think that especially if he can take that like another step forward with the bat, don't get me wrong, what he's done has been excellent with the bat, especially for a catcher. Yeah. But if he can have a really loud year where he hits like 320 to 330, 12 to 15 bombs, like that's only going to really help his cause. So
yeah,
I'm glad you hit on Yannick, because I think that while he's well represented right now in the top 100, I think he's 84th. That's a guy who I think can climb even further.
Oh, is it a soft J pronunciation as well? I've been saying.
Yeah, so funny. I was That's in the Janik camp, and then I went to go watch him this summer, and the PA guy was like Yannick, and I was like, what?
Yannick sounds cooler anyway, so I really approve of that that adjustment. I'll have to mentally account for that.
It is a great name, too. But yeah, he's a very fun player.
Yeah, you had mentioned his zone contact. I think it just in terms, just to finally like close tie bow on this one in our catcher conversation, his zone contact rate is pretty similar to Caleb Loma Vida and Jacob Cozart, who are top two college catchers. His overall contact is not quite at that level, and I think part of it is the approach. His chase rate was a little more aggressive than both Cozart and Loma Vida, particularly with the gap from Cozart. And also just the top end exit velocities are a little bit further away from those two. So if he can come out a little stronger, shore up the offensive approach and really put up big numbers in that conference, I think like just hearing the way scouts are talking about him this summer at events, like people just talking about the class in general, he seems to have a really sterling defensive reputation. And if he can layer on some more offensive performance and clean up some of the underlying things. I think it's a really attractive profile overall. But enough of the college catcher demographic. I think it's a really solid one, and maybe on draft day it could look a lot better than it does right now. Where do you want to head next, Peter? Because there are any number of things we could talk about in this draft class. So I'm curious if you have a demographic, a player that moved up the board, a player that moved down, or maybe some more players further towards the back half of the list that you're excited about. Let's just take it wherever you want to go now.
Yeah, I'm gonna stick with a couple of like these so-called lurkers, like in the 40 on range, who they're well represented right now, but could very well be solid like first round types when we get to July. I'll start with Dakota Jordan from Mississippi State.
I was gonna mention him, so I'm glad that you did.
Yes, yeah, like I tweeted about him last week, and I think the best way to describe him.
You zeted about him, you mean?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I axed zeted.
Yeah.
I spoke about him last week, and I think the best way to talk about him is he's just super, super freaky.
Yes.
And he's a physical specimen, 6 foot, 220 pounds. He was a great football player in high school. He's a great athlete. The bat speed in the box, it's an 80. Like it's
I think JJ mentioned this last year on Twitter. Just saw, there was a video of him homering that went fairly viral on social media, and JJ quoted it and was like, if you want to know what bat speed looks like, watch this. And I thought it was like summed up extremely well. I don't think there's a player in this class that has quicker pure bat speed than he does. It is like tremendously fast the way he is able to like get the barrel through the zone.
I was going to say, in a class where you can talk about so many guys kind of close to one another, whether it be top of the board, a positional group, a certain tool, Dakota Jordan is the bat speed standard. Like, there's not one guy I think that comes rather close than maybe like Caglione on some of the swings he gets off, but on the consistent 80 grade bat speed, Jordan's the guy, and he's got 70 raw power to all fields.
If you look at
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you look at 90th percentile exit velocity in all of college baseball last year, like regardless of class, the top five players were Kemp Alderman at Mississippi, Warren Laster at University of Incarnate Word, Jack Caglione at Florida, Dakota Jordan, and Joe Vitrano. So these are like the elite EV guys, and it was completely unsurprising to me to see Dakota Jordan's exit velocity numbers just be right there with Jack.
They're eye popping, and he's a draft eligible sophomore too, so he can only have so much of a track record. He had a strong freshman year at Mississippi State. He had 307 with 19 extra base hits, including 10 home runs, 44 RBIs in 40 games. And then in the NECBL, surprisingly enough, we can get into the nuances of summer ball and summer ball contracts if we'd like, but he would have played on the Cape. He could have played on the Cape, but if you send in a contract for the NECBL, you can't get released from it. He sent in his contract. He had his great year. He can't play in the Cape. So he went to the NECBL. He had 379 in 11 games. The approach, which I think right now, and just simply making contact, is the biggest key for Jordan in terms of maximizing his upside. He had the same number of walks as he did K's in the NECBL. And then in one game with USA, we're talking about a 12-game sample size and a small one. Like the bat to ball skills are going to need to improve, but in the 12 games this summer, he swung and missed at zero fastballs, which I don't care where you're playing or who you're playing against. That's impressive. And I think that that's a very positive development for him. And then when you kind of get into these underlying numbers, like you were saying, the 90th percentile exit velocity, the max exit velocity of 118.6 was also the fourth highest at the D1 level.
That's just silly.
And then when you go to the average exit velocity, it's 93.9, which to the naked eye, it might seem less loud and less eye-popping, but Jack Caglione's average exit velocity, at least what I have here, was 93.7. So he is right there with these upper echelon guys.
I think Dylan Cruz was also in a similar 93 range last year, if I remember correctly, and he stood out for at least like top of the class guys a year ago with one of the better average exits. His was a couple ticks higher than that. Maybe in pro ball he had a 93 EV with Wood, which that would track. I think on average it's about a 2 mph adjustment from the metal to the wood for most players. But either way, continue.
No, I'm with you. Like the impact that he's able to generate when he makes contact is really second to none in this class. But again, like the approach, he's going to really have to clean it up. Like the pitch recognition skills. Like if he's able to do that, I think you're looking at a huge sophomore year that he's going to be able to have, and someone who could very well play his way into the first round. But again, that's kind of the big question mark with him. So he's a little bit volatile in terms of his stock. And then in the outfield, again, you mentioned the athleticism, which is really, really solid. He's a great football player in high school. The actions are surprisingly good. Like, he's got a quick feet. The arm is average. Like, the instincts are there. It could translate well to center field. But again, when you're talking about, like, maybe a little bit of a knock on the profile, is I think he's probably best and ends up long term in left field, which isn't too much of a hit. But he's a guy right now at 41 that I think has a golden opportunity to play himself higher and into that top 25 to 30 overall pick range.
Okay, I'm going to name two more players, two kind of last players to hit on for me that I'm intrigued about, and get your thoughts, because they are both college players, and then I'll let you maybe have the final word on this updated list. But I'll stick with the kind of two-way football player, baseball player, athletic demographic here, and go with Will Taylor, who is a guy who is consistently tough for me to place on a draft board. He seems fairly polarizing in the industry, at least in the reporting that I've been able to do on him. He was obviously a very highly regarded high school player coming out of the 2021 class. He was kind of alongside Bubba Chandler as two sport athletes committed to Clemson. Chandler signed out of high school. Taylor made it to campus, where he did play as a wide receiver and a punt returner with Clemson. When I was like going over this profile and report, I was like, man, why didn't I take Taylor for my speed profile? Because he can turn in double plus times. But he also had a really good offensive year. He didn't play every day in 2022. It was kind of a mediocre or below average offensive season, I think you could say. In 2023, he hit 361, 488, 521 in 62 games. It's an OPS over 1,000. He homered five times, doubled 16 times, stole 11 bags, and wasn't caught once. He struggled on the Cape this summer, did not have the greatest outing. It was a 231, 349, 337 line with an 18% strikeout rate. So I think there are still questions about what is he ultimately as a hitter in his offensive profile. Like, the defensive profile, the supplemental tools, the speed, the defensive ability, the ball tracking skills that kind of translate from the football field, I think make him a really appealing up the middle profile. If he is able to sort of refine the offensive approach, I'm not sure how much power he's ever going to get to. He does not have anything close to Dakota Jordan bat speed or physicality or strength. I don't think he necessarily needs that to move out the board next ring, but I'm curious what you think about him as a player and as a hitter specifically.
Yeah, I think Taylor, again, he had that really good sophomore year at Clemson. The former, again, former football player who is actually like a legit football player in Clemson. He caught a touchdown last year. So like, we're not talking about a guy who was like rostered, like he played on Clemson. But like, great year offensively in the spring. You mentioned he had 362. There really wasn't a lot of power there. Like, he can run. I think he's gotten into like the running ability less than, you know, I'd maybe like in game. He only swiped 11 bases. And then this summer I caught him a few times, which again, it's enough to formulate an opinion on him. Maybe not a final one, but I don't know. I think that he fits well right here in this like 45 to 55 range. Certainly like anyone can in the draft class, he can play his way up as really as far as conceivably possible with a strong showing this spring. But for me, I kind of like him more down here. I wasn't super impressed offensively this summer.
Yeah.
It like I was really excited it coming into the summer to get a look at him. And I was even more excited when I heard that like the football wouldn't interfere. He'd be able to be there for the whole time and get a quality summer under his belt. I was left like just wanting more with Taylor. Like, I didn't see these flashes that I was expecting. I think that I left thinking he'd probably be best in left field defensively. Again, the plate skills need work. And in terms of generating impact, nothing really blew me away. Again, yeah. I'm getting real nitpicky here.
I am hopeful that a year off of football and focusing on baseball will kind of allow him to get back more towards that pedigree he had coming out of high school. Because I think the way you're talking about him is the way the industry feels about him. Just given how highly regarded he was in high school, he hasn't quite lived up to that reputation now. And people are now trying to like figure out is this the real Taylor the whole time? Does he have more to unlock when he's focused on baseball? So he'll be really interesting to see next spring.
Right. And that's a great point, because Brody Brecht is in a similar boat a little bit. Granted, Brecht has the arguably, like, from a pure stuff standpoint, probably the loudest stuff in the class. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit different. But like, he just now also had his first fall, and Brody Brecht needs to improve in his strike throwing ability, establishing himself as a starting pitcher. And that those are all things that people are really hopefully can do with focusing on baseball full time, playing fall baseball, like being a one sport guy. And I think that that's absolutely fair to say with Taylor too. Like, this is his first fall baseball. You know, can he clean up his plate skills? Can he just refine his game overall more? And I think that this spring, I think what people are going to want to see is definitely some more impact, because right now he's got, he played 13 games as a true freshman. So like, he's really got, he's got six home runs as across a season and a handful of games. So really just one full season, so to speak, he's got six home runs. If he can get into that 15 to 20 range, which is going to be a big jump, but one I think he'll need to take in order to kind of work his way into that, like into a higher round discussion, that's going to be a big key for him. And I think that there will be some people who still hold his performance on the Cape maybe a little bit against him and as a little bit of a red flag, but seeing how he's able to improve and what he looks like as a one sport guy is going to be really enticing, because again, a great point that you made with the skills that he has on the football field and how they translate to the baseball field, like especially on the ball tracking front and the athleticism, like the athleticism is next level with him. That's also a great point and in a underlying tool, so to speak, that not others have. But I think my overall thoughts on Taylor is, like, if I'm a director or like a front office guy and I'm somehow in this crazy world, I'm the only one running the draft and picking the draft. He's more a second, third round type guy for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm with you in terms of where I'd have him now, but he is one that I'm like really excited to see next spring and hope I get some more consensus on him from the industry and just with me personally as well. Any final guy you want to mention here, Peter, before we wrap up or closing comments?
Yeah, and keeping it to one guy. So I have three guys who I think right now that are in that, let's see, 46 to 60 range, or excuse me, yes, 46 to 60 range, who could play themselves into the first round. I'll name all three. I'll talk about one.
Okay.
Trey Savage from ECU is one guy who I think could be a first round pick without a doubt. RJ Green from Cal Berkeley, I think, has a very Dylan Beavers-ish, again, lazy comp.
Comp. I think it's a decent comp.
Yeah, he's got some Dylan Beavers to his game. He's got a chance to really, really pop with a good spring. And then Carson Benj down at 60. Benj right now, I'll talk about him because I think he has a chance to make the biggest numerical jump on our board between now and draft time. He missed his true freshman year at Oklahoma State. So he is a redshirt freshman, first year college player with the Cowboys last year. He had 345 with 17 doubles, 7 home runs, 43 RBI, and more walks at 42 than strikeouts at 32. And then on a 9-game stint on the Cape, he also ironically hit 345 with 5 RBI or 4 RBIs rather. And he would have stayed there the whole summer had he not gotten banged up. Like, I was able to watch him once on the Cape, and I was really excited about what he brought in terms of pure tools and just his game in general and the overall package. But what stood out to me is, you know, guys either have this or they don't for the most part. Like, when watching him play, you can tell that he loves to play and like just loves to play baseball. He couldn't care less if it was the Cape or on Mars. Like, if he got to play baseball, like, he was going to love every second of it. And seeing that in a player has unfortunately become a little bit more rare nowadays, and something that I was really happy about. And getting back to him as a player, you know, kind of that wiry athletic build at 6'1", 184, maybe some room to add some more impact. It's a violent swing. Like, there's a big time barrel tip. It's geared towards doing a ton of damage and getting the ball up in the air. He generates backspin consistently. Again, he played at Oklahoma State, which notoriously is a launch pad, but these home runs like weren't cheap ones. Like, he generated impact to all fields. It's above average bat to ball skills. And like, with a lot of moving parts, like bench and this swing, like this huge, like almost like loopy at times swing, or steep swing is a better word for it. In this steep swing with that barrel tip, like, he consistently is on time and gets in a good position to hit. And against velo, like, and he hammers heaters, like against fastballs, 91 and up, he slashed 529, 691, 824. Like, he pulverizes fastballs and he moves well in right field. It's a no doubt 60 grade arm that's going to allow him to stick in the position long term. And he's someone who this spring is going to log innings on the mound. He's been up to 96 with some field of spin. Curveball will flash depth. He's not going to pitch professionally. Like, he'll be drafted as an outfielder, but he will log innings this spring for Oklahoma State and probably look good doing it. And there's big time bat speed there. There's just a lot to like. And then the intangibles when looking under the hood with Benj just make me like him all that much more. And again, in this world where I'm a one-man draft guy with final say, I'm not going to be super, super afraid to use a first round or a comp pick on him.
I love it. You got me really excited about Benj. You can now be the Benj bandwagon leader, Peter.
Gladly.
You've done your work for Seaver King. You've gotten him into the top 10 at this point, and Benj can be your next one. So when he goes in the first round next spring, you can take your victory lap once again, Peter.
Sounds good.
Well, that's about going to wrap us up for today. Anything you want to plug or mention before we get out of here, Peter?
Yeah, just finished up the top 30 for the Marlins, which was incredibly rewarding. It was 12,000 words and 30 pages. So for those who purchased the handbook, I encourage anyone listening to this episode and any episode to purchase the handbook, because you're going to get not only 30 pages on the Miami Marlins, you're going to get 30 pages or similarly to every single organization in baseball and everything that you need to know about the guys at the major league level, the guys coming through the system, sleepers, anything you want on any team is going to be in there. So I can't recommend that enough. And then on what's to come, freshman spotlight pieces will continue, I think, for another week or two, and then going to shift gears a little bit next week, starting with releasing the top 10 college players in the 2025 class. More than anything, it's just going to kind of be a personal board, because we've had little time to discuss 2025, and rightfully so, because there's just no reason to focus on it, but just going to look down the pike a little bit into those guys. And then the following week, I'm going to mention 10 or so assistant coaches who are like hot rising young names in college baseball right now, because there are a lot of assistant coaches who I think down the road are going to be known commodities. So it'll be fun to take a look at that as well.
Very cool. Just to add to that, we now have all of our National League top 10s on the site. If you want a preview of what's coming in the prospect handbook, half the league is there now. This week, we're starting to roll out AL East top 10s. Next week, winter meetings will be happening, and that means draft lottery. So we'll have draft lottery coverage. We'll have our first full first round mock draft, which, again, it's December, or it will be December by the time you're listening to the podcast and by the time the draft lottery is rolling around. So take that for what it's worth. But we did it last year, and I think 20 or so of the players on that mock were first rounders. I'll have to double check those numbers. But draft lottery for people who are excited about this new wrinkle of the draft. Maybe for an A's fan or a former A's fan, you're not so much excited. But that's happening. That's probably the big draft event on the calendar. We'll have coverage of that in a lot of different ways at baseballamerica.com. So I'll just kind of echo what Peter said. Check out the handbook if that's something you're interested in. Check out a BA sub if you're interested in just the conversation we have here every week, or prospects or baseball in general. But for Peter, I'm Carlos. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time.